Good morning, everybody. Corbin, now that we have made sure that you are not aware how glorious the weather is outside, I think we are ready to start our July ASAP. Okay, so we'll start with a discussion on principles of disclosure. I'll give the floor to Mariella.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Agenda paper 2, we have put together there a few slides. We aim to provide you with an update of where we are with the outreach activities on the discussion paper, and to ask you as well to share any input, any feedback that you have already gathered, so that we have a better understanding of areas of concern, of areas of general agreement. And also maybe it is an opportunity for other ASAP members to learn about issues that they haven't observed yet, but they might be then investigating during the next 3 months until the coming period finishes. So slides 3 to 5 of the deck provide you with an overview of the activities that we have carried out so far, or activities that we are planning to carry out in the next few weeks. And those activities are classified per jurisdictions and type of stakeholder. And as always happens, after we put together the slides, we learn about new events that will be taking place during the next few weeks, but they don't change significantly the overall picture. And we think overall that at the end of the coming period, we'll have a fairly good coverage in terms of both jurisdictions and types of stakeholders. Slides 6 to 7 of the presentation provide you with an overview of the comments that we have received so far. And the main statement that I could make is that there is overall support for the project, but we have then received specific comments on the different sections. Starting with the principles of effective communication, this is not a controversial section of the discussion paper. There is general agreement on the principles that they can contribute to making information and communication more effectively. Some wonder, though, whether there should be a hierarchy within these principles, whether they should all have the same way. And therefore, from there, then think of some of them might need to be mandatory and some of them might not need to be mandatory. Within the section about the role of the primary financial statement and the notes, there is a general reflection that comes out from some stakeholders when talking about this section, and it's about the role of the financial statements within the broader financial reporting. And what these stakeholders think is that this role might need to be defined better, considering the influence of integrated reporting and the impact of technology. So a question that these stakeholders often raise is whether the financial statement should be self-contained with clearly defined boundaries, or should they actually be integrated with the rest of the financial reporting package or the annual report. In relation to the section about location of information, and particularly about IFRS information outside the financial statements, there are diverging views that range from stakeholders being generally in favor of the use of cross-references of IFRS information placed outside, and some stakeholders being generally against the use of cross-references. And a few stakeholders also saying that what is important at the end of the day is to find a balance, and not everything can be cross-referenced somewhere else, but cross-reference can indeed help to avoid duplication. And you can see that this range of views affect the views that these stakeholders have on the proposed criteria for dealing with this situation in the discussion paper. So some question, for example, the boundary of the annual report for placing IFRS information outside the financial statements, something that it should be beyond the annual report, and those would be the ones that clearly are in favor of cross-referencing. But some others then have concerns about cross-referencing widely, and therefore they agree that the annual report should be the boundary. And the same with auditability issues. So the ones that are agreeing in use of cross-references more widely, then they think that audit issues can be fixed and can be solved. The ones that are a bit more concerned, they raised the issue that information needs to be still be audited. IFRS information needs still to be audited, even though placed outside. The ones that have also some concerns, then what they raise the question of whether we are blurring the lines between financial statements and the annual report. We have also seen mixed views from those from non-IFRS information placed inside the financial statements. So we have stakeholders that think that non-IFRS information can actually be useful to explain the story of the entity. And we have also stakeholders that think that inclusion of non-IFRS information should be primarily given in the MD&A and not in the financial statement.
Off duty.
The stakeholders that tend to be disagreeing of incorporating non-IFRS information in the financial statements wonder whether we are opening the gate for more non-IFRS information within the financial statements. Auditability of this information is also a concern for them, because having non-audited information could lead to financial statements losing credibility. And the proposed criteria for dealing with this issue in the discussion paper is also challenged. For example, the proposed requirement to provide a list of this non-IFRS information within the financial statements is perceived as being burdensome. And also the proposed requirement to explain why this non-IFRS information is useful is also perceived as maybe not making much sense when that information, for example, is required by local regulations. Performance measures, general agreement in the proposed requirements for fair presentation, particularly among users. But there's always some comments about the specific requirements. For example, some say that more guidance would be needed around the proposed requirement that performance measures should be reconciled to the most closely related IFRS information. So what is this most closely related IFRS information? So more guidance would be needed. Or other stakeholders ask, how could prominence be assessed? And prominence being related to the requirement of performance measures should not be given more prominent than IFRS information. In relation to unusual and infrequently occurring items, a lot of stakeholders welcome guidance, that the board develops guidance on this area. They do not think that the board should be actually defining the term, but rather delineating better the population of items that would warrant separate presentation in the statement of financial performance. Accounting policies is a section of the discussion paper that I wouldn't define it as a controversial section. And as a matter of fact, we are receiving similar comments than the ones that have been described already in the discussion paper. Some stakeholders think that only category one, which are the accounting policies that relate to material items, transactional events, but have suffered a change or represent an option, should be the ones that should be disclosed, whereas others think that all accounting policies that refer to material items, transactional events, should be the ones that need to be disclosed. So similar discussions than the ones reflected already in the discussion paper. Drafting disclosure objectives and requirements. So, well, we have a mix of views in here. So some stakeholders prefer method A for developing centralized disclosure objectives. Some others prefer method B. There is somehow an overall support for an approach that would include an overall disclosure objective supported by detailed disclosure requirements. And linking this with the discussion about how would a review of disclosure requirements look like in the future, some have stated that maybe a better solution for the disclosure problem would be reviewing specific standards rather than performing a holistic review. And as a matter of fact, then IFRS 7 is one of the standards that has been highlighted a few times already. as being burdensome for preparers to fulfill those requirements, especially for preparers that are not financial institutions. In relation to the approach developed by the staff of the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board, we have also received mixed views. I think there are some stakeholders that appreciate the flexibility that this approach could provide, and those stakeholders are particularly the ones that see the disclosure problem more related to disclosure overload. So they think that this approach could be an interesting approach to consider in the future. There are some other stakeholders that have expressed some concerns. They are not sure how effective the approach would be in practice. And one of the items that I have mentioned is that maybe some of those disclosure objectives are a bit too boilerplate. In relation to the disclosure problem as a whole, some stakeholders stated that the reasons behind the disclosure problem are indeed behavioral, cultural. Entities face internal and external pressures, and these pressures result basically in more information being included rather than excluded. Some stakeholders expect that the direction of the next steps of the project will actually be to address the disclosure overload, which is the concern of financial statements having too much irrelevant information. At the same time, there are also some other stakeholders that wonder whether the disclosure overload is a real problem when we consider different tools at hand to retrieve and consume information. We had a meeting with a group of academics that they provided the following feedback. The description of the disclosure problem does not include management incentives or moral hazard, and that might indicate then that the description of the problem is not complete. Of course, when dealing with a disclosure problem, materiality is an issue that comes out, and what the stakeholders say is that the cases when information is obviously immaterial or when it is obviously material are easy cases to deal with. The difficulty is in assessing materiality that deals with the gray cases and probably at the larger population of situations. And in that sense, then these stakeholders stated that more guidance would be needed. Then we refer to the materiality practice statement in those instances, and the stakeholders wonder sometimes why is the materiality practice statement non-mandatory. And the final point that doesn't deal necessarily with any specific section of the discussion paper but has been highlighted in many events is the interaction between the principles in the discussion paper with digital reporting. And what this stakeholder said is that the discussion paper does not discuss the impact of technology in the delivery of information in detail. And with that, then, I think the overview of the comments received so far is finished, and then we would like to understand the feedback that you have already gathered, whether it is aligned or aligned, or whether there are any other issues that we should be aware of.
I open the floor. Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. I think the feedback we hear is largely in line with what you describe. If I have one thing to add, or probably two comments to add, the first thing is some constituents in our jurisdiction are not clear about the final state of that project. So what is the ultimate objective that you're trying to achieve? Is it to put bandage around a few issues that have been accounted, or is this to provide a robust framework that will take us, say, into the next 10, 15, 20 years? And if you follow the first objective, you could probably say, and most people I think do, that these principles that have been developed are helpful in addressing these issues, but it's not the giant leap forward that would take us into the next round of the reporting. The second comment that I would make is really that something that you have touched on several times, firstly about your last point about digital and integrated reporting, but also the overlap between financial and non-financial reporting. I think if you read the principles with cold blood, you would say, well, it's hard to disagree with them. Yeah. So, I mean, this is common sense. But the question that people are raising is, what's the object that we are applying these principles to? Is it still a book called the annual report? Is it a four-page? And a number of pages are being devoted to something we call the notes. Or is it something that's really boundless because information, as you say, are being promulgated electronically and they are being digested electronically? So hardly anybody reads an annual report from end to back end anymore, but picks and chooses and let the machine do the rest. So, and if that's the case, then you may wonder whether some of the answers that are being proposed in the paper really are answers that would solve the bigger disclosure problem, so to say. So the comment that we hear from the analysts is there is no disclosure problem. There never was. Yeah, the more disclosure, the better. Preparers are obviously the other way around, but then the question is, are they the other way around because they also think about the end product, a book? I think if you said, well, once the information is being produced and it's being disseminated, who cares? But it's really to put them all in one book that's then being audited, given a certain level of assurance and all these things, that then makes people feel uncomfortable, I think.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. I guess we heard very similar views from what the up. There are many discussions in the paper that are very abstract and difficult to disagree, but we are not sure how that would actually improve practice, and we'd like to see more about that. Regarding technology, we might have a different view from what Andres just mentioned. We would like the ISB to focus on the book. And after you decide what should be in that book, then we can think about how to apply technology to that. That would be our approach. And regarding the proposals, some stakeholders have told us that it's very difficult to understand method B and how that would apply. There is an example there, but it's not enough to give us the whole picture on how significantly the disclosures might change. It's difficult to imagine because we don't have the details. So that's the feedback we got.
Thank you. I'd like to share the results of outreach in Asia-Oceania region so far. The AFC members generally agreed with the principles of effective communication. However, they expressed concerns about operationality of the principles in practice and suggested the ISB provide illustrative examples which apply the principles. But they showed mixed views regarding whether the principles should be mandatory or not. The ISB members generally agreed with the staff recommendation with some concerns about the role of the primary financial statements. One member believed that the role of the primary financial statements should be providing enough information of major line items rather than providing summary information of those items. Another member was of the view that the role of a primary financial statements should not give the impression that it is superior to the notes. And the ELC members generally agreed including non-IFRS information in the financial statements should not be prohibited. Some people expressed that those non-IFRS information should be reconciled to IFRS. Another member is of the view that any amount that does not meet IFRS definitions and recognition criteria should be prohibited from being included in the financial statements. They think that it needs clarifying what constitutes an annual report. Some members expressed that it would not need limiting to annual report if it meets the criteria. And some members mentioned that the only audited information should be permitted. And they expressed the cross-reference the IFRS information must be identifiable and auditable. Regarding use of performance measures in the financial statements, IOS members broadly disagreed with defining and separately presenting unusual or infrequently occurring items. Some people were concerned about possible abuse of presentation of unusual or infrequently occurring items. They showed mixed views regarding requiring presentation of EBIT in the income statements. The LSC members generally agreed with the staff recommendation of disclosure of accounting policies. One member suggested that the accounting policies which an entity chooses among alternatives should be placed in four part of the notes to help compare with the other entities, and the other accounting policies be placed in the notes of related items. Regarding centralized disclosure objectives, LSC members generally agreed that the ISP should not require either method A or method B, and they think both should be allowed. One member suggested that the ISP set mandatory disclosure requirements, and each jurisdiction have discretion for disclosure of others. They also suggested that the ISP provide mandatory disclosure requirements by industry. Yeah, some member said. Another member suggested that considering very fast technology advances, we should consider improvement of disclosure from the future-oriented perspective beyond XBRL, like AI or big data. Yeah. Thank you.
Linda.
Thanks. So I won't repeat anything that Mariella talked about because you sat through some of our outreach that we've already conducted in Canada in terms of our advisory groups. We have held three series of roundtables thus far on this project, and as well going back to something I referenced, I think at the March ASAF meeting in February, we held two panels with very sophisticated investors in Canada, one buy side, one sell side, probably around 25 analysts in total, talking about it started out by talking about the relevance of the audited financial statements. But very quickly got into a discussion around what they use to make decisions that goes beyond the audited financial statements. So in light of that, I guess a few comments to make. I think everybody agrees there's a disclosure problem, but the root of the disclosure problem that different stakeholders describe is quite interesting in terms of how they describe it and what they would like to see. Users in particular feel that the audited financial statements are very relevant, but only from a confirmatory perspective, and that they make their decisions when they get new information less on the basis of the actual financial statements issued and more on the basis of what they can get from data aggregators very quickly. And then after the fact, they will go back and make sure that in general, the information they get from the data aggregators is consistent. Notice how I said that, is consistent with financial statements as opposed to reconciles to financial statements. And one of the things that I think
Linda,
that
if I may interrupt.
Yeah.
So what kind of information do they get more quickly from the data aggregators?
The disaggregated amounts that perhaps, so the data aggregator will take a line. But then because the entity is providing outside of the financial statements supplementary information, the data aggregator will pick up both
but
of them.
But that is still backward-looking information.
It is still backward-looking, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
absolutely.
But more disaggregating.
But more disaggregating that would be required to, and they imply, actually, Hans, that it's more disaggregated than what would even be required to be in the notes to the financial statements. There's very little delineation in our discussions between the primary financial statements and the notes. We almost tend to group that together as opposed to think of them separately. So where we are right now, so we've held roundtables, and we held them early on for two reasons. One is we wanted to create awareness around the discussion paper, because often it's very difficult to get in particular preparers interested in a discussion paper early enough to get them involved in the process. When you have earlier roundtables, you have to give them a bit more structure because people haven't read the discussion paper yet. So you kind of have to get them intrigued in the parts of the discussion paper. We tend to send out material ahead of time so that they actually will have read that particular section of the paper before they show up. So we've done that. We are now considering having some more discussions in September, closer to the response date, just to kind of fill that out. So what the themes seem to be is that everybody just agrees that there's a disclosure problem, but they want to go at it in a different way. They do say that there's only so much that the ISB can do to resolve the disclosure problem, because many of the disclosures seem to come from different sources. And in particular, things like, and we're going to talk about wider corporate reporting tomorrow, but things like climate-related disclosures, other environmental impact disclosures, liquidity disclosures that go beyond what you might require, et cetera. So there's these add-on disclosures that regulators or others impose, and therefore the ISB, that's not part of the ISB's remit, and are you going to be able to influence that? So that was also a common theme. But one of the most interesting things that we have learned so far is there seems to be no awareness, even with the most sophisticated investors, where the financial statements and therefore the related audit opinion stops, and what happens beyond that, and what are the governance processes around that supplementary disclosure. So, for instance, users have told us that 20% of what the information they get is actually from the audit to financial statements, rule of thumb, and 80% is from other sources. But they have absolutely no idea what the governance practices in an entity are to ensure that 80% of information is consistent with the audited financial statements. Long story short, I think as we go forward in understanding this, there's a couple of things that we need to understand. One is that the users are going far beyond the book. Okay, and they don't have a level of awareness of how that additional information reconciles with the book. And secondly, auditors are expressing concerns that depending on where this goes, if you're going to have information outside of the financial statements that is covered by their audit opinion, how many documents are they going to have to look at to make sure that their audit opinion is still consistent and relevant? And so we're getting different views in terms of what will actually happen as a result of the proposals. And that leads me to believe that we need to engage. One group I haven't heard talked about, but that we've talked about, is boards of directors and audit committees and what their roles are in oversight of this information. So we've had one initial discussion with the chairs of three audit committees who gave us some really interesting feedback in that regard and what they would like to see. So we'll take that into consideration. But also the notion of the digital impact of financial statements and what's that going to mean in the future. And I'm very quickly feeling like a dinosaur because I actually think about financial statements as the book, but others don't. And I'm going to have to figure out how to think about that.
Kim.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, certainly in our jurisdiction, some similar comments to what Andreas mentioned in terms of the format that this is going to be presented. So I must say, in reading the discussion paper and looking at, you know, approach A and B, the question that I had was, is there a difference between determining sort of what information should be provided versus, you know, the how it's put together and the packaging? So therefore, in reading between, well, looking at method A and method B, I was asking myself whether or not the actual information content at the end of the day is going to, well, you know, would it or should it be different between method A and method B? And arguably the answer should be no. We should, you know, it's the content that we, you know, need to be, you know, all comfortable with. And then it's the question of how is, if you like, the story told. And I think for me, as Linda mentioned, you know, this then certainly goes into the wider corporate reporting space then, and integrated reporting. So looking at method B, it really there, I think, you know, fits more in line with the concept of integrated reporting, telling the story of the business, the entity's activities. And I say, I think, you know, it's not just the financial, it would be some of the non-financial, which I think is, you know, where it goes into the wider corporate reporting. But so I think that you know, initially there needs to be a focus on the what information, you know, that needs to be. And then, of course, you know, whether or not it is going to be the book form or it's going to be, you know, a digital or whatever form, that could affect the sort of how, and say, that story is told. Because, and I guess the challenge is that there are various different issues in this disclosure problem. I mean, for example, if I look at the financial instruments disclosures, when IFRS, you know, 7 came out, okay, so people would now have this note for financial instruments, and then they would, you know, deal with things. And then subsequent to the initial issue of IFRS 7, there might have been some amendments. And then what entities tend to do is that they just add another new note. So maybe their notes ended at, you know, note 100. Now we have note 101, which now deals with whatever this new requirement is. And then there's another new disclosure requirement, and now we have a note 102, et cetera, et cetera. And then you would find that when you then read the financials, well, they were disjointed. They didn't go back and sort of revise the financial instruments note. Now, but that is more in the space of putting the information together to then tell the story. So that's why I think that, you know, maybe in terms from the board's perspective, in terms of identifying the what, you know, whether or not that is simply done, well, that should be done in the most efficient and effective manner, and maybe that is where it would be around saying, well, for assets, you know, what are the types of disclosures that would be appropriate, and whether or not it's property, plants and equipment, investment property, you know, operating assets, non-operating assets, whatever, would there not be similar types of information that should be provided? And again, that's the whole what. And then the way the information is put together is going to then go into how the entity tells the story. Because I certainly think that, you know, while there's some comments which say, well, there's not really a disclosure overload per se because we'll go and find the information, for people that either don't know where to start, or they don't have the time, or they're not quite sure, you know, there certainly is a lot of merit in having something which is concise to tell the story of the entity's operations. And I think that speaks to the integrated reporting of telling the story about the business and the performance. So for me, you know, whether or not it's method A or method B, I think that it's more focusing on the what and then, you know, packaging the story. Some of the other things as well, I think while centralized, you know, objectives are certainly important, it also needs to be clear within certain specific requirements what the purpose is. And I say, again, just to pick an example, looking at, commitments to acquire future, you know, property, plants and equipment. In practice, questions arise, so what does a commitment mean? Does it mean that I've actually, you know, got an order with a supplier that I'm committed to buying this with a third party? Or is it simply that internally management have put together a budget and are committed internally to spending this money? Now, you know, if it's clear, well, what is the purpose of this disclosure, then that's so certainly helps to inform preparers in terms of the type of information. So, so as I say, I think, you know, lots of interesting views that are being expressed at the moment.
Kimberly?
So we've held roundtables in both New Zealand and Australia, so what I'm going to go through now is really a compilation of the general themes for the two jurisdictions. We can give you the detail separately. So in terms of the question about what areas that people generally agreed with, section one around the identification of what the disclosure problem is, the principles of effective communication was general agreement with, and that they should be non-mandatory. When it got into location of information, I think a lot of the feedback is similar to what we've heard. When you're talking about inside the financial statements, general view that you shouldn't be prohibiting the inclusion of that information. I guess some caveats that if you're talking about a non-IFRS performance measure on the face of the financial statements, it really has to be calculated in accordance with IFRS, which of course is what, you know, IS1 worry requires. and also comments that it could be quite challenging to determine what is or isn't IFRS versus non-IFRS. So this idea that you can somehow identify it is problematic, given that you know, if it's useful, IS1 establishes you should provide useful information. When you're getting into the location outside the financial statements, that's where yes, people understand the rationale for doing that, that it you know, avoids that duplication. But then, of course, you then do have concerns about is it audited or not, and that's where people definitely get into that digital technology debate about are we really thinking about the book, or are we really thinking about an electronic form? In which case, you know, clearly there's going to be, you know, pieces of information, and then that does arise challenges with identifying what is or isn't audited, and particularly from an auditor's perspective, bearing in mind they give their opinion on the entire financial statements. There's not necessarily, even if you say this piece of information is audited, that's done in the context of the financial statement as a whole. People might be misled in thinking basically the little bit of assurance that's provided on that. So that then did get into a discussion about, well, what are we trying to achieve for the future? Do we need to revisit the that whole question about the financial statement boundary? In terms of performance measures, general agreement with the principles around fair presentation of performance measures. Noted it's very consistent with what the new regulators require on the use of those measures outside the financial statements. General disagreement with the idea of defining or requiring the presentation of useful or infrequently occurring items. So comment around it's back to the future with extraordinary items. We're going to start creating, you know, prescriptive definitions and requirements around that. In terms of accounting policies, general agreement that yes, we want category one. No, we shouldn't need to provide category three, the immaterial. Mixed views on the category, the second category, you know, for the reasons outlined in the discussion paper, that that some people think they don't need them, they're already familiar with accounting requirements, whereas others saying, well, you can't assume that all users need that information. And so some people were suggesting maybe you can resolve that through how you present them, that or maybe they could be on a website, maybe they could be at the back of the financial statements, and so sort of highlighting what are the more judgmental policies versus the ones where you've justified the requirements of the standard. In terms of things like objectives and the NZASB staff approach to drafting disclosure requirements, general agreement with the ideas that there should be disclosure objectives, that they are, you know, very helpful, both general broader objectives and specific objectives. Greater emphasis on using judgment was seen as very helpful. Similarly, less prescriptive wording as well. I think we got some mixed feedback on the Tier 1 versus Tier 2. Some very supportive of the idea, and particularly linking in with that emphasis on judgment. Some preparers were saying, and I think you need to bear in mind this feedback's in the context of the New Zealand environment, in particular, where in Australia, where entities have gone through that process of rebanking their financial statements. So some of them were saying that the guidance we already have of IS1 with materiality can actually get you to more effective communications. But then some were saying that that change of mindset hasn't necessarily happened with their auditors. So having greater emphasis on judgment and saying, yes, we need to think about what's relevant, will force the auditors to move away from their comfort of their checklist. And then, of course, the opposite, and this opposite view was coming from auditors, was, well, if you introduce this judgment and you've got those entities that apply what we might call a minimalist approach to their disclosures and are looking for excuses not to disclose information, they take advantage of it. And then that also then transformed into a further discussion around digital reporting. Could you perhaps transform the Tier 1, Tier 2 idea into this, because it was a, bearing in mind we phrased that as summary and additional, selecting the core and more idea and digital reporting. Could you have kind of like the key pieces of information are your Tier 1, and then you can click on links to your additional information, and that would perhaps resolve people that just really want to know, well, what are the key pieces of information, they can just read that. People who want more detail can then click on links and get the more detail. So it's sort of drawing an analogy between the tier one, tier two, with the digital reporting debate. And that certainly was a general theme that came through about thinking about digital reporting. And I suppose the other, only other thing I wanted to add to that in terms of anything else to share around the outreach that, that we've done. We in both cases, we did it in roundtable format in both jurisdictions. So putting people, instead of sort of having a lecture format, we had people sitting at tables with staff or board members at each table facilitating the discussion, and that was a very effective way of getting people talking. We also very much appreciated the ISB staff giving a presentation at the start of our events, particularly from a New Zealand perspective, given how late in the evening it was for the time that we were doing that, and that was very helpful to hear directly, and we really appreciated that. So thank you again.
Alberto.
We had informal discussions so far with our stakeholders, and two main concerns have arisen. One is about this cross-referencing outside the financial statement. The reason is, I must say, may say conceptual. I mean, if an information is useful to better understand the financial statement, why should it be outside the financial statement? If an information is necessary to give a true and fair view of the financial statement, why should it be outside the financial statement? Another reason is that saying outside the financial statement might be too vague. I mean, yes, the management commentary is maybe the best place, but say outside without specifying which documents create problems. For instance, one may make reference to a press release, but the press release might disappear from the website after 2 weeks, and the financial statement is still there with the missing information. That's one concern. The other one is about the proposed permission to label some items, generally speaking, expenses, as unusual and infrequent.
Always.
We all know that in the management commentary, the directors gives their opinion about what is not supposed to recur in the future. Everybody seems to be so confident that can look into the future. So, and we see many, many items labeled as unusual, infrequent. They tend to recur every time, so the most frequent items are those who are labeled as infrequent. So the concern is either the board is able to give a very robust definition of what is an unusual, exceptional, and non-recurring, infrequently recurring, expected not to recur items, or without this robust definition, the most people thinks that we should stay as we are now. Expense is expense. You can label in the financial statement, stay as an expense, and then in the management commentary, they can do whatever they like. And so that's the two main concerns.
Alexander.
First, the paper was very well received in the region, so and two comments that are, I believe, is important for the discussion here. The first one is two elements of the paper, which is the need to reconcile everything to GAAP, EBITDA, EBIT, or any other form of financial or non-GAAP information. Is already a requirement in Brazil. It is working very well. So you can present any information you want, any non-GAAP information you want, but you have to reconcile every information you provide to the near GAAP figure. Because sometimes you have not only non-recurrent earnings, but we have non-recurrent expenses and etc. So we have to reconcile it to the nearest gap figure. So that's working very well. It's easy to enforce, but people like it. The other thing is a requirement in Brazil is this, that there is a clear mandate by the Securities and Exchange Commission. There is a clear command not to disclose irrelevant information. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is trying to enforce that. But that's very difficult to enforce. Because what people say about that information is relevant to me. And I believe that is relevant. So they start a discussion which is very hard to be. So it's a very important principle, everybody agrees, but some people are more cynics and say, well, that's like world peace. Everybody will agree, but when you get into the details, that's the problem. So it was well received in principle, but the experience of enforcing that particular study is something that we should take into account. The second comment is actually a question about the content of different reports. So you mentioned about the press release, and some people say, well, it should be clear what is a press release, what is the executive summary of the MD&A, what is the MD&A, and then what is in the financial statements. Because some companies are designing their reporting system that way. So if you have 2 minutes, you read the press release. If you have 10 minutes, you read the executive summary on the MD&A. If you have more time, you read the MD&A. Then you get more detail. But at the end of the day, the information, they are not completely, you cannot move to those documents in a different order. What I mean is, some information that are in the MD&A are not in the financial statements. And some people don't see that as a problem because they say, well, I release both together. And so I'm explaining a few things that are on the financial statements. For example, the business context of a given impairment, for example. They give much more detail on the MD&A than in the financial statements. And sometimes vice versa, they give more information in financial statements than in the MD&A. So most companies see both pieces as complement to each other. And say, well, shouldn't we guys treat that in some form and say, well, that's appropriate, so that's acceptable, or this is what we are talking about. So to discuss specifically the relationship between the documents and how they intersect with each other. And finally, that's more of a wishful thinking in terms of, should we apply all of this to integrated reporting? I think that you mentioned that, touched that, but those principles will be applied also to integrated report. So, but integrated report has a different framework with different principles, and they are at the moment not easily reconciled. So it should be interesting to have something along those lines. So, to apply the principles, 7 principles, but to apply them to the whole integrated reporting. For example, they treat differently the question of materiality. They have a strong focus on materiality on the IRC framework, but it's different from the discussion that you guys are having here. So some people say, well, it should be interesting to have those two documents speaking the same language. That's it.
Andrew.
Thank you. Well, EFRAG issued a draft comment letter at the beginning of last month in line with our normal process, and we're about halfway through quite an extensive program of outreach in different parts of Europe. We've been involved in 2 user-oriented outreach events so far and 3 general ones with about 4 to go, and all in cooperation with national standard setters or user organisations and with the ISB, for which we're grateful. I'm sorry, Mario, you've heard the EFRAG tentative view so many times already, but we appreciate your patience. So I'll try and to sort of synthesise our draft comment letter and the feedback we've received so far. So a few points of more detail. On the cross-referencing question, I think the balance of comments so far is to support a broader and principle-based approach to cross-referencing. You could characterise it as, is the main issue to try and reduce duplication, or is the main issue to try and preserve what some would call the integrity of financial statements as a standalone document I would say, more in the first camp, but there are some mixed views on that point. On non-IFRS information, it's rather academic to talk about prohibiting non-IFRS information in the financial statements. I think we're kind of well past that stage. There is non-IFRS information in financial statements, and I believe, for example, Michael Bloomberg's Climate Risk Disclosure Task Force recommended that these climate risk disclosures are within the financial statements envelope as well, for example. So the idea is in the discussion paper to try and ensure non-IFRS information is fairly presented. We think are exactly right, but perhaps a slightly more forensic approach is needed, because there's probably a subcategory of information like employee numbers or that don't really need any additional baggage attached, fairly self-explanatory and inoffensive. There might also be a further category of information which is so egregious that it should actually be prohibited, and that the sort of remedies proposed in the discussion paper just wouldn't quite do the job. But we fully, someone characterised this as supplemental information, non-gap information, and anti-gap information. Now, I fully appreciate that trying then to delineate these three categories will be very challenging, maybe could be too challenging and add too much complexity, but we think that's the sort of way to try and think about it to achieve a sharper focus. Now, on accounting policies, I've been trying really hard to get people to sort of come off the fence on the category two, what I'll call the non-specific but material accounting policies. I'm finding it very hard for some to think this. Not quite willing to grasp the nettle and say we don't need this, but maybe we could put them on the website. Those sorts of ideas keep coming up. So, well, we'll see if we land on that point. On the nature of disclosure principles, people seem to support the idea of more objective or principle-based disclosure requirements, most certainly. On the method A, method B, some interest in method B, but I think people need to kind of see what it looks like before they can really respond, and I don't think we've seen that yet. I would like to put in a word for the I think New Zealand Accounting Standard Board staff approach of a two-tiered approach. It seems to hold out some promise to find a balance between a reasonable level of comparability, but whilst allowing a more explicit permission to apply judgment and materiality judgment on the level of detail to go into. So that's something we think is certainly worth exploring further. But the overall message in our draft comment letter is undoubtedly that we think there is a still unresolved disclosure overload problem. We characterise it in that way. And we're sceptical that focusing on materiality and communication of information is fully going to do the job. A lot of companies have done a lot of work in this area already. Of course, companies are at different stages in their journeys, and it's not a journey that ends, it's a sort of continuous attention, continuous improvement process. But we do think the major outstanding piece of work, the priority for the ISB, should be a comprehensive review of disclosure requirements. So in the summary of high-level comments so far, the suggestion that this ambition might be reined back to focus on just a handful of standards, quite a range between focusing on a few standards and focusing on all of them, but we'd be concerned if the ISB is going to sort of reduce its ambitions in this area, because I think there's a high level of expectation that a comprehensive review of disclosure requirements will be undertaken. We'd like to see a timetable around that, and we'd like to see a clear focus, not an exclusive focus, but a clear focus on looking for opportunities to simplify requirements and eliminate any that are redundant or disproportionate.
So Mariela, how does this jive with the comment on page 7 that apparently most of our constituents said do not recommend to redraft all standards, but to focus on improving just a few? This looks, Andrew's speaking on behalf of quite a few constituents.
Yeah, well, I think there are some group of preparers that are particularly affected by specific standards. IFRS 7 is one of them, IFRS 2, IFRS 19. and they would, and some of those preparers as well, they said that they have never been prevented to provide the best useful information just because of the standards themselves. They have also appreciated the IS1 amendments. So I think there is a variety of considerations in them to say, well, actually, we can deal with most of the matters, but there are a few standards that are problematic to us.
But this is not the overall message that you got from, from our constituents. Don't do a comprehensive review.
For specific preparers.
Okay.
And I think it's fair to say we're at an early stage of the outreach. We're only just halfway through the comment period, so that the messages that we'll get will develop over time, I would have thought.
Patrick?
Thank you. We have a working group that has been meeting a number of times, and we have an outreach scheduled for September. In general, there is support to the initiative, in line with previous efforts carried out in France, because it seems that we have in France a tendency to be more voluminous than anywhere else, at least, and we have the standard setter and the stock exchange regulator have expressed twice the concern that we were overloading really too much. So it's spot on in terms of, you know, the convergence in terms of initiative. From a very general standpoint, in a digital environment, the question is not so much the overload, because you have a volume of information that is huge anyway, but it is the structure of this information, the quality of each of the layers of the information, and therefore the prioritization for people that want to access information. The 1 minute, 10 minute, 10 hour exercise. So, and that's one, by the way, I open a parenthesis, that will be one of the themes of our symposium in December, to what are the consequences of digital. Because you can't just put the emphasis on the overload, because in fact, overload, where does it start? You know, you have information all over the place anyway. So, and that's of course, if you discuss overload, you're talking probably about coherence, i.e., what is the perimeter, the scope of what you define as financial information. Therefore, our constituents are seriously concerned about what has been mentioned, the integrity of financial statements and the related operational, who is issuing that, governance, who is approving it, and of course auditing issues. We think that a standard setter cannot probably operate on a standalone basis on this topic, because it's related to MDNA, it's related to governance, it's related to audit techniques and audit responsibilities. So it's a cross-cutting issue. So whatever will be done will have to be confronted with what people think in the other areas that are concerned. And the cross-referencing, of course, everybody admits the idea that repeating information is a bad idea, and cross-referencing seems to be a consequence. But on the other hand, if you end up with financial statements that are just a list of reference to other bits and pieces of information, do we still have financial statements? From a more practical standpoint, in terms of how it should be done, and that has been just discussed, conceptual framework should maybe have something on this topic in order to guide standard setting, IS1 certainly, elements of it. And we support the norm by norm approach, with probably a priority on the most crucial ones. So page 7, I think you can reconcile. It's a timing issue.
Yeah.
In terms of approach B and A, there is a dream for the best of both worlds, I think, because people realize that approach A is a bit formal and a bit, classification, and B is more, quote-unquote, intelligent, but more difficult and not specified enough, I think, at this stage, of course. So the best of both worlds would be ideal. Finally, there is a general request for flexibility in a principles-based environment, and of course this is linked also to what has been said in terms of materiality. What part of the overload is coming from immaterial information, probably? Thank you.
Michelle has news from China.
China aren't here, so that passed their comments, and I said I'd pass them on. So I think the first point builds on a point that Kimberly says, actually, where they're concerned that highly principle-based disclosure requirements may lead to abuse of judgment in practice, and that entities' information in the same industry may not be comparable and may make regulation more difficult. They consider it's better all parties need when developing the requirements of disclosure, not only the principle-based objective and policy, but also the application guidance and the illustrative examples. They are also seeking comments on stakeholders' views in China's, and will send their formal feedback. But they've made a suggestion that the ISB draft a questionnaire to all stakeholders to seek the views on what information is most directly relevant to them and what disclosure manner is the most effective communication. And they would obviously support that questionnaire.
And I've also asked for the noise to stop. You'll be pleased to know.
I
just wanted to comment quickly on the point I think that Andrew raised about people being, keen for us to get on with reviewing the disclosure requirements and the standards, which is something I hear a lot. And certainly the examples that you gave of, I think, duplication and things that are sort of redundant, completely agree with that. I think for me the challenge as a board member thinking about doing that, much as I'd love to get onto it, is the question of the how bit of the discussion, to use Kim's terminology, of the differentiation between the what and the how. I think in the past we tended to write disclosure requirements that were a lot about the what. So it was a list of you have to provide information on A, B, C and D, and that's got us to a sort of data dump and a tick box sort of situation. So in the last few years we've started to move towards trying to help with the how as well, by starting to introduce more words about sort of what the objectives of this, of the requirements are. So if you look at the new impairment requirements, it starts off saying information needs to be provided to enable users to understand particular things, and then we go on to the examples of how you might achieve that. But at the moment, I'm spending a disproportionate amount of my time having conversations with very worried prudential regulators and very worried users of financial statements, because they're really anxious that when the IFRS 9 stuff comes out, it's just going to be a data dump, because people seem to be focusing so much on calculating the ECL numbers, they're really worried, they don't know yet, but they're really worried that people aren't really going to step back and look at those objectives. And so I think for me, one of the really interesting pieces of information we're going to start getting next year will be seeing how well those objective-based disclosures are actually working in terms of how they get good quality communication at the end. Now, and I think we need to be a little bit fair that people have got a huge job to do just to calculate ECL, so maybe their disclosures will improve over time, so we should be kind. But I think it comes back to Patrick's point. It's a big sort of behavioural change. We can write words, but it requires a whole load of other people in the system to work together to get that change. And I think we need to see some of that pan out, because I'd hate to just deal with the duplication and that stuff without having the opportunity to think about how we actually write it to get a better result. And that, for me, is still a little bit of a missing piece of the jigsaw.
Okay, well, just a few words from my side. Some of you have said those principles of effective communication in the document. Hard to disagree with, pretty self-evident, and that's how I looked at it as well. But as you know, we are working on a small publication which shows how preparers around the world have tried to improve their the quality of their and effectiveness of this their disclosures. And I've seen a first trial of it, and we'll show a couple of concrete examples how they did it, and then we apply, we show which of the nine principles, well, there were like nine principles of effective communication, or seven, and we show which of the seven apply to that specific improvement. And then it goes, so then it starts, these abstract principles come alive. And it also shows that it is not nearly as self-evident as it seems to be, because otherwise they would have done it a long time ago. And okay. Probably a lot of companies are still not doing it. Yeah. So I think that this publication might really help to give some inspiration to companies to work with these principles. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. We're a little bit behind, but it doesn't matter.